Welcome to the Full 60 featuring Craig Custance and presented by The Athletic. Each week, we'll dive into the biggest stories in hockey while bringing in unique voices to entertain and explain all aspects of the game.
Hey, this is Craig, and welcome to this week's episode of the Full 60. It is an absolute honor to introduce our guest this week. It is Willie O'Ree, who is author of a book that I finished this week, fantastic book called Willie, The Game-Changing Story of the NHL's First Black Player. Mr. O'Ree, thank you so much for doing this. I am so excited to have you on the show today.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, where to start? This book, I mean, it's a lifetime of stories, but how did the idea come together? When did you first kind of get the inkling this was something you wanted to do?
Well, Michael McKinley, who was the author, and we were involved in a children's book, the autobiography of Willie O'Ree, small children's book, the ages 8 to 12, 8 to 13. And then Michael asked me if I ever thought of giving thought to another adult book, you know, which would go in detail with your life and your hockey career and everything else that had been going on. And I said, it'd be nice. So it kind of went in one ear and out the other. And then he finally got back to me and said, let's do it. So then I got together with my my agent, Eustace King. Yeah. And said that Michael McKinley is interested in doing this book. So we got it going. We started talking on the phone for hours and, you know, a lot of questions. And I'd sent him material. And I had to go way back and in my garage. And I had boxes there that I hadn't looked in a number of years. Hmm. And pulled out some stuff that they thought that they would useful for the book. So that's how it all started. And, I'm very happy on the outcome. I think Indigo did a fine job, and it not only tells about my hockey career, but it tells about my life after hockey.
Yeah, and there was what I really appreciated on top of that was there was so much history. And that was part of it too, right? Just woven into it that I thought was really, really beautifully done, and I love that. And one of the first people I wanted to talk to you along those lines was a player that I wasn't familiar with before I read this book in Herb Carnegie. Who is Herb Carnegie, and what did he mean to you as a player?
Oh, Herb, I had met Herb on several occasions. I never saw him play in person, but I read about his career through the hockey news, and I knew one of the players that played with her, Manny McIntyre, is from my hometown in Fredericton. And together with him and Ozzy, combined that all black line that played in Sherbrooke, Quebec, and then played under the leadership of Punch Amlach with the Quebec Aces, and you know, played with John Beliveau. Herb, it was just an all-around good hockey player. Should have been in the National Hockey League before me. He had all the skills and all the talent that a hockey player would need. And it's just unfortunate that just didn't happen at that time. But I hope still that he has the opportunity to get into the Hall of Fame, because he deserves it.
Yeah, that absolutely, and you know, there was all these considerations, you know, that was, I thought, was fascinating. Like, he gets this opportunity with the New York Rangers, but right, as you pointed out, like, there was a good living to be made in you know, if you were willing to play this higher level minor league, that
right,
when there's only, you know, six NHL teams, maybe it's not worth taking the risk or moving your family or doing all these other considerations.
That's true.
Yeah, and that was, you know, all of those details I found really fascinating. And one of the things that jumped out, Willie, to put us into the moment was you being in California, in Los Angeles during the riots. And I'm in Detroit, and you know, people here still talk about 68, the riots in 67, 68.
The Watts riots, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was playing there during that time.
Yeah, what was that like to experience? And I would, and I'm just curious, as you know, very in the moment now with everything that's happening in the social justice causes in our country, what is it like to be experiencing this in the, in this moment from your perspective?
Well, I kind of, I knew what was going on, and the riots and the burning and the looting and everything, and I basically didn't really go down into the area, but I had read about it, and you know, I was playing at the time, but. But I just thought that unfortunately these things happen and they're still happening today. Mm-hmm. But it's a learning experience if you have to be in the area when one of those riots are going on, because it is frightening, and so many buildings were looted and burned, and so many people lost their businesses and their homes. But I had the opportunity to be there, and
It's what's really stood out to me is and you would have this perspective, we've seen it now where it's become a national conversation, and then it also becomes a conversation in the sport of hockey, right? Like this was at the forefront, especially during the playoffs. Were there similar conversations like that in that time period in hockey, and in having it be more representative and that sort of thing, or did it not carry over this to the same degree?
No, it didn't really carry over, and I'm glad it didn't. I mean, it was something that happened, and it was a tragic period, but I just kind of stuck to playing hockey and try to represent the hockey club, to the best of my ability.
How about being a part of the California hockey scene at the outset, right? You play in LA, you play in San Diego, and this is right around the time of expansion. Yes. How was it to be part of kind of that? I mean, you were a pioneer on so many levels, but also in that moment in the expansion west.
Yeah, well, when I came to San Diego in 1967, that was the first expansion of the NHL. They expanded six teams, and the team that was here in San Diego, I had a good year my last year, and I was hoping that possibly I would be contacted to come and try out, but nobody contacted me, and I didn't take it upon myself to go down and say, "Hey, I'd like to try out for this team." They knew that I was in San Diego. The team. They know my hockey career and how I played and the goals that I scored and so on and so forth. But I watched them play, and I was very supportive of the team. I went to the games, I was hoping that I would get the opportunities to just go and try out. And to see if I was still good enough to make the team, but it didn't happen. But after I had retired in 1980, I relatively wanted to stay in hockey in some capacity, because I felt that I had something to give back to the game, what hockey had given me over the 21 years that I played. And I had been involved with youth development programs in my hometown. Mm-hmm. Before I even left to go play junior up in Quebec. So I said to myself, "Willie, you're going to get back into the NHL in some capacity." Yeah. That was the goal that I set for myself. And I had several jobs. I sold cars at the John Hine Pontiac, a local dealership in San Diego. I worked construction. I got into the private security business and worked there for 15 years. But my goal was, Willie, you're going to get in back. You're going to get back into hockey. And then I was working over at the Hotel Del Coronado, a historical hotel over in Coronado Island, a very, very nice hotel. And I was working there in the security department. And I'd been there just closing out of my fifth year. And Brian McBride, who was a newly appointed vice president of the NHL's diversity program at that time, was in a meeting in New York with Lou Vero from USA Hockey and four or five other businessmen. And they're talking about how the NHL and USA Hockey could get together and combine and make it possible for more boys and girls to get into playing hockey. And Jackie Robinson's name come up, and they said, yeah, Robinson, you know, broke the color barrier back in 1947 and opened the doors for black players and players of color to play baseball. Well, just at that time, Lou Vero, out of the blue, says, well, we have our own Jackie Robinson in hockey. And the room went silent. And everybody looked around, and they said, well, who is it? And Lou Vero said, oh, Willie O'Ree. He says, I was living in New York, and he came up with the Boston Bruins, and I watched them play in the old Madison Square Gardens, and a hell of a hockey player. Scored a goal against the Rangers, and, you know, Lou's team was the Rangers. So Brian McBride just happened to say, well, is he still alive? Is he still around? And Lou said, yeah, he was playing out there in California with that the San Diego Gulls in the Western League. So Brian says, well, I'm gonna make it a point to try and get in touch with him. So he called, and he couldn't get my number, but he knew a couple of FBI agents in the San Diego area. And he called them, and he says, I'd like to get some help. He says, I know Mr. O'Ree is in San Diego, and I'd like to see if I could get a hold of him. So within a few hours, the gentleman called back and said, yeah, he's working over at the Hotel Del in the security department. So Brian called me and said, Willie, he says, I'm Brian McBride. And I says, yeah. And I was a little hesitant. And he says, yeah, he says, I'm with the NHL's diversity program, and I'd like to know if you'd like to get involved. We have a program here with kids. And so he kind of laid the program out, and I said, yeah, I believe that's something that I'd like to be involved with. So one thing led to another, and I went back to New York, and he laid the program out, and I said, this is that. Now, this was 1996, and I says, I was still working at the Dell, and he says, I'd like to have a hockey of a weekend of kids honoring your breaking the color barrier in 1958. We'll bring these kids into Boston, and they'll have a weekend of hockey. And so I got the time off and came to Boston, and was introduced to all the boys and girls, and talked about my life in hockey, and it was great. And then about a couple of weeks later, he said, Willie, he said, I'd like you to go to Bellingham. There's a program up there, and they would love you to come up and give a presentation. And I said, well, gosh, you know, I'm still working. But I told my boss, and he said, yeah, Willie, we'll get somebody to cover for you. So I go up. And then Brian had two or three other functions that he wanted me to take care of. And I said, gee, Brian, I said, this. No, and he says, well, how tight are you in with the Hotel Del? I says, well, I'd need to give him 2 weeks' notice if I was going to leave. He says, yes. He says, I'd like you to come aboard. So I gave my 2 weeks' notice. Now I'm going to Boston and starting this program. We only had five programs at the start when I came aboard. We have about between 32 and 36 now.
Yeah.
And
wow.
I was jumping for joy when I found out the type of work they wanted me to go to. Visit schools, boys and girls clubs, juvenile detention facilities, YMYD, WCAs, and talk to the boys and girls about, you know, getting into hockey. And once that started, I mean, honest, it just kind of mushroomed, and kids started coming out of the woodwork. We started conducting clinics and having these kids come and get on the ice, and we'd teach kids how to skate, and then we'd bring them up in just the basic fundamentals of the game and get them playing. And it was great. It was the thing that I really wanted to do, and I put my heart and soul into it.
That's amazing on so many levels. It's amazing that you, they had to find you. They had to get the FBI. Like, that to me still blows my mind, Willie.
Yeah, I'll tell you, when the FBI wants to find you, they'll find you.
I can't even wrap my head around that. And, you know, and the beauty of it is, and you mentioned the growth of the program. I was in Flint, Michigan in, I want to say, January or February. And here's Rico Phillips has Rico. A trophy. Who's Rico's the best.
Yeah.
And he's got your trophy with your hat on it. And he says, he's like, I carry this. This is like a key to get into any room I need to. I just pull out this trophy with Willie O'Ree's hat. And I can reach kids. And like, that's the impact you're having.
Yeah, he's a beautiful human being. I was only there in Flint in the one time. And I got such a wonderful response and a gracious invitation to not only the kids, but to the parents. And I watched a hockey game and I signed autographs and gave, you know, autograph pictures away. And I've talked to Rico, you know, four or five times on the phone. His program is doing well. And then, that's just one incident of making one trip, you know, to a city. And then all of a sudden things just started happening. And I'm very happy for him, and he's moved on to other things relating to kids. So, you know, life is good.
One of the stories he shared, he said because he's helping introduce hockey to these kids, and what he was worried of is he wasn't preparing them for what they might hear on the ice well enough.
Oh,
like, he would
hear
from parents, right?
Yes.
And they would say, hey, we had to deal with this because it is still – you know, it's a predominantly white sport. And he's like, and so he's like, he said he called you. He's like, well, what do I tell these parents? And you know, what advice do you give to parents in that situation?
I just tell them, you know, that these boys and girls, you can't change the color of your skin, and you wouldn't want to. If people can't accept them for the individuals that they are, then that's their problem. And I just tell them they're going to hear the racial, you know, the racial slurs and the racial comments, but just let it go. I know it's tough, and it's a lot tougher now than it was for me, but just let it go in one ear and out the other, and just go out and play your game and score goals and work hard. You know, there's no substitute for hard work. You only get out of a thing what you put into it. But the parents, just they're crying when they see their son or daughter coming off the ice crying because they've heard a racial slur, a racial remark. I think now, you know, with the NHL rules and the players that are playing, not only the black players, but the players of color that are playing in the NHL now, any racial remarks or racial slurs that are said and these people are ejected from the arena, and it should be. They, you know, it's these boys and girls and these players in the NHL. They're there because not only because of their color, they're there because they have the skills and the ability to play there. They've proven themselves that they're good enough to play in the league.
Yeah, and I love what Rico said. You also at the end of the conversation, you said, you know what, the best thing we can do is fill the rinks, right?
That's right.
Like, let's diversify it by filling the rinks.
Exactly.
And so then it's not a, you know, it's not a thing. And in your book you wrote, you know, and it's still not there, right? And you wrote, you know, black NHLers are never just hockey players.
No.
And that's something that, you know, I think the league is still struggling with now on some level.
That's true, yeah. That's the old saying, you can't see beyond the forest for trees.
Mm.
You know, you can't look beyond that. But it's, you know, I've had racial remarks directed towards me, and I haven't played in the league since 1961. You know, I've been at a gas station filling up my, you know, my vehicle or in a department store or just out, you know, socializing. And I've heard it from people that I've never met before. They may know of me, but I don't know of them. But I just look at them and just say, you know, We've still got a long ways to go, but we're working in the right direction.
You and I actually met years ago, and obviously you'll never remember this because, I mean, who am I? But we met in Atlanta, Georgia during the All-Star weekend.
During the All-Star? Okay.
Yeah, it was And Gary Bettman and I, you and I and Gary went to this place called Ron Clark Academy. It was this inner city school, and to watch them, you know, it was just fun for me. I was a fly on the wall watching them interact with you, and there was a lot of, you know, stuff that goes around a All-Star Weekend.
Right.
But I was reminded of that when I was reading your book because, you know, I'm a Michigan native. I happened to be living in Atlanta at the time, but I didn't, you know, I don't think about Georgia in the past, you know, in that context.
Right.
And I'm reading up about, you know, you going down there to try out for the Milwaukee Braves. What was that experience like? And, I mean, completely different experience.
Well, first of all, you know, I was playing for the Marysville Royals. And I was having a pretty good year, you know. I was a 300 hitter.
Yeah.
And when the two scouts came and said, you know, Mr. E, we're represented by the Milwaukee Braves minor league operations, and we'd like to invite you down to training camp in Waycross, Georgia. And soon they said, Waycross, Georgia. I said, no. I says, I appreciate the offer, but I would just rather stay and play baseball here. Because I still had hockey on my mind, you know, in the back of it. You know, I was still in hockey, and I played baseball to keep myself in shape, and I was making a few bucks. So they said, well, you're just giving up a fantastic opportunity. There's not too many black players that we have come across with your talent, and we'd sure like you to come. So I talked to my parents, and they said, oh gosh, no, because they knew the way blacks were treated in the South, you know. And they says, oh no, they would just say to me, oh gosh, no, you'd probably get hurt. So then I talked to my older brother, who was not only my brother and my friend, but he was my mentor. Taught me so many things that I would need to know, my brother Richard. And he says, well, how do you feel inside? How do you feel deep inside? And I said, gosh, I'd like to go down for the experience. He says, well, then go. So I jump on a plane. I land in Atlanta, Georgia, stepped off the plane, walked into the terminal, and the first thing I saw was restrooms, white only and colored only. So I went into the colored restroom, and I come out, and I had to stay in Atlanta overnight. So I went out and contacted a black cab driver and explained my situation. I've got to stay in Atlanta overnight. Could you recommend a hotel where I could stay? Because I'm going to get on a bus the next morning going to Waycross. So he took me to an all-black neighborhood, nice little hotel, stayed there. Next day on the bus, I arrived in Waycross, Georgia, got off the bus, was assigned a dorm with about 8 or 9 other baseball players, but they were black or players of color. The next day, he issued uniform, and I was a shortstop and second baseman. So we started working out, and I could hear some of the racial remarks from some of the white players, but it didn't bother me, you know, back and forth with practice. And I was there the first week, and going into the second week, and outside of the dorm, they would have a list, and if your name appeared on that list, that means you were going to be sent back home. So it was just, I think it was just the end of the week. We had played an exhibition game. It was just the end of the week. And my name appears on the list. So I go in, and they said, Willie, we were impressed with your play, but we think you need a little more seasoning, and so we're going to send you back home. So I gave the impression that, oh gosh, I wish I could stay longer, you know, but deep down inside, I was jumping for joy.
Yeah.
So I get on the bus, and I was 5 days on the bus. And back then, you know, blacks had to sit on the back of the bus. So I sat on the back of the bus, and as the bus was rambling up through the northern states and we're getting closer up north, I started moving up in the bus. And I was at the center of the bus. And by the time I got to Bangor, Maine, I was sitting in the front of the bus. In about another 4 hours, I would arrive in Fredericton. I get off the bus when I arrived in Fredericton. I stepped off the bus and I said, Willie, forget about baseball. Concentrate on hockey. And then that's when Punch Imlach contacted me and invited me to the Quebec Aces training camp up in Quebec in 1956. And I went up and made the team. And from then on, it was started with the going to the Bruins training camp the next 2 years in 57 and 58. And then I was recalled all up for two games in 1958. But I think if I had been offered a baseball contract, I'd have turned it down. I really would have deep in my heart said, no, Willie, this isn't for you. And again, too, my goal was to hopefully play professional hockey and one day possibly get into the NHL.
What was that 5-day bus ride back? What was that like?
I actually, the only time I got off the bus was to go to run into a restaurant, you know, or grab a sandwich or grab a drink and stay in the bus, because I had a couple incidents in Waycross, and I felt that if I just stay on the bus, probably I won't get into any problems or get into any trouble. But it was a long bus ride, and I just kept thinking, my fingers crossed, that I would arrive in Fredericton safely.
Not knowing what to expect with, you know, every turn of your experiences as I was reading this, I was really encouraged by the Boston Bruins and the treatment you got, right? Because,
oh, yeah.
You know, I was imagining the worst, I guess,
back then.
You know, yeah. Right. What was it like to get that call up and to be kind of embraced by that group as you made
debut? You know, when I went to their training camp in 1957, the other black player that I played with, Stan Maxwell, both of us went to training camp. Had a good training camp, and then we came back to Quebec and played with the Quebec Aces and finished the season. And the next year in 1958, went to the Bruins training camp again and had a nice camp. To be honest with you, the Bruin organization is a wonderful organization, right from the top. And Lynn Patrick, the GM, and Milt, the coach, and, you know, all the players that I had the pleasure of playing with. So when I came back to Quebec, and then on January the 18th, the Bruins contacted the Aces and says, we want to meet the Bruins in Montreal to play two games. So I take the train. I go get into Montreal before the game. Milt Schmidt, a coach, and Lynn Patrick, the general manager, sat me down and said, Willie, we brought you up because we think that you can add a little something to the team. Don't worry about anything else. You're a Bruin, and the Bruin organization is behind you 100%. Well, I was no stranger to the Montreal fans because I had played in the Montreal Forum against the Montreal Junior Canadiens, the Montreal Royals, but this was a regular scheduled NHL game. And I had the butterflies. So I go out, and then the first shift, and then I settled down, and I played a reasonably good game. I didn't get any goals, no penalties, no assists. But we were fortunate to beat Canadians 3-0. We shut them out right on Saturday night, right in Montreal, and that was a big feat in itself. So after the game, my parents had come up from Fredericton. Some of my close friends came up and said, oh gosh, Willie, what a game, so on and so forth. And I didn't realize till the next day that I had, you know, I had broken the color barrier and opened the doors up for not only black players and players of color. I didn't realize it till I read it in the paper. So we get on the train, both teams, the Canadians had their car, the Bruins had their car. We go into Boston, we play there Sunday night, and Canadians beat us, I believe, 5-3. And I go back to Quebec, and I was keeping my fingers crossed that I get another opportunity to be brought up. But I played, and then I got the call back in 1960 and 61, and went up, and I played a total of 45 games with the Bruins, and I scored 10 goals and 4 assists.
And I look at the numbers you put up, in San Diego, in playing, and I'm just thinking, boy, if that league had been just a little bit bigger, you know what I mean? Like, if it was what it was now, you would have been a 30-40 goal scorer.
I still figured when I had retired, I was 44, and I still, when I sat up there in the stands and I was watching the San Diego team practice, and I can honestly say that I could have played better than some of those players that they kept. I really could, even with the one eye. I was dumbfounded when I was watching some of these guys. But it was a new league. They needed players, you know, and they filled them up. But I never the only regret I had is I wish I had played in the NHL a little longer. But I didn't know it was the fact that they found out about my eye injury. But I was very happy with my output, and the Bruin organization has been great. It's I'm a Bruin fan, and I always say that they have a wonderful organization.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I'm going to jump around a little bit here because there's a couple other topics I want to hit on. But I don't know how I missed this. You met Jackie Robinson not once, but twice. How does the universe align? Like that? Do you mind sharing that story? I love to see that.
I was 14, and I was playing baseball in my hometown. And again, I played shortstop and second base, and we won the league. And the reward was that our team was going to be taken to New York to see the Empire State Building and Radio Music City Hall and all the attractions. And we saw Jackie play at Ebbets Field, Brooklyn. And after the game, I went down and was introduced to him at the dugout. I shook hands with him, and I told Mr. Robinson, I said, "Mr. Robinson, I not only play baseball, but I play hockey." And he says, "Oh, I didn't realize that there were any black kids playing hockey." And I said, "Yeah, there are a few, Mr. Robinson." So, he said, "Well, whatever sport you choose," he said, "work as hard as you can." He says, there's no substitute for hard work." And that kind of stuck with me. So we go back to Fredericton. That was in 1949. In 1961, I was traded to the Los Angeles Blades. I was playing in Hull with the Hull of the Canadians. Sammy Pollock was the general manager, and he traded me with the two other players and some cash. So here I am out in Los Angeles, joining the Los Angeles Blades, and I was having a good season. In 1962. The NAACP in Los Angeles had a luncheon for Mr. Robinson. I received an invitation through the hockey club. So I go to the luncheon, and I was there with myself, two other players, and the coach. And when I arrived there, Mr. Robinson was standing over in the corner talking to some media people. Well, when he finished, the coach came over and said, "Mr. Robinson," he said, "I'd like to introduce you to three local players here, especially Willie O'Ree, who was newly acquired from a team back east." And Mr. Robinson turned, and he looked me in the eye, and he pointed and he said, "Willie O'Ree," he says, "aren't you the young fella I met in Brooklyn?" Now, this was 1949, and he remembers me meeting me in 1962 with all the millions of people that he had mentioned and met. I guess it maybe stuck with him because I told him I not only played baseball, but I played hockey. And then he commented, he says, "Well, it looks like you picked the sport that you talked about." And I said, "Yes, Mr. Robinson." And we talked for another 4 or 5 minutes, but he made a big impact on me and through my life and still does when I remember, having the opportunity to meet him two times.
That's amazing. And that he remembered you is mind-blowing.
Yes, after all those years.
So when you hear people refer to you as the Jackie Robinson of hockey, I know you've looked at that as a compliment.
Very much. Yeah. I'm very happy and to be in the same category as Mr. Mr. Robinson when they call me. And it was the media that gave me the name, the Jackie Robinson. I didn't say I was the Jackie Robinson, but was recalled back up. They says, oh, well, there's Willie O'Ree. He's the Jackie Robinson of hockey. Mm. And it stuck with me over the years. And I'm very thrilled to, you know, to be, when they mentioned Jackie Robinson and mentioned my name.
Media not, didn't look great when I was, there was, you know, you share the story about how basically the media blaming black players for not arriving sooner rather than the league. I was, to me, I just, it was so shameful to see that.
Yeah. Well, Herb Carnegie should have been there. He really should have. When he went to the Leafs training camp, he went to the Rangers training camp. He was just overlooked. You know, he was overlooked because of his color. You know, Herb Carnegie should have been in the National Hockey League. And it's a shame because he had proven himself. He was the best player at training camp, you know. And how do you turn down being one of the best players?
Right. You mentioned the impact your brother Richard had on your career.
Oh, gosh.
And I did want to get into your family a little bit. What else to him, like, do you still carry to this day?
He was not only my brother and my friend, but he was my mentor. Mm-hmm. And he taught me a lot of things that I would need to know. He knew the type of hockey player I was. He knew the goal that I had set for myself of, you know, playing pro and hopefully playing in the National Hockey League. And I had the pleasure of playing with my brother. He was about 12 or 14 years older than me. And I would play with him. And, you know, I was like 14 and I was playing with guys, you know, 18, 19. And, but I held my own. And sometimes I would practice, you know, against him. And sometimes he'd, you know, take me into the boards, clean check, you know, take me in hard. And I'd, the tears would come to my eyes and I'd say, brother, I said, why you hit me so hard? He says, I'm only preparing you for if you decide that you want to play pro hockey, you're going to get hit a lot harder than this. And he was right. I'm glad that the checks that he gave me, because then I had to know about taking checks and making, you know, different moves to avoid checks. And I still give him, you know, a lot of credit for the 21 years that I was able to play.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about, you know, the impact you've made, and you really, it was really fascinating for you to kind of trace back the impact. I mean, we all have people in our kind of family tree that changed the course of generations. And in your case, it was Paris O'Ree. Do you mind sharing kind of discovering his story and what that process was like for you?
Well, you know, I didn't know too much about my ancestries. Mm-hmm. And when I got involved with the documentary with Brian McBride and Lawrence Mabee, the young lady that was doing the filming, she had researched a lot of my information about a lot of my ancestors and where they came from and where they lived. And she told me about them, and I couldn't believe it. So we went down to South Carolina and went into the archives there, and they brought out the books, and they turned to the pages where Paris was and where his family and how he got there and the property that he owned, and then how he was became the slave and then was let go and migrated up to Canada. But I was overwhelmed when I read it, and to think that he sacrificed a lot. But I believe he set goals for himself and what he wanted to do and where he wanted to take his family and the things that he wanted to accomplish. But it was an eye opener, and I've got the map. I had a copy of the map with the land where he lived, and see, the name O'Ree, it was H-O-R-R-Y. When you say O'Ree, But then when he was, when the British were there in South Carolina, and when he came and they said, your name, he says, it's O'Ree. And the British officer or whatever, when they pronounced it, he thought it was O-R-E, O-R-E-E. And that's how the name was changed from Horry to O'Ree. And I was so happy that I had the opportunity to go down to South Carolina and actually go through the archives there and find out a lot about my my ancestors.
That's you, by my math, you're his great great grandson, right? Like, we're not talking about, like, you know, a thousand greats. Like, this is great great grandson you are. That's amazing. And then the last thing I want to get into in terms of family, one of nine children, which, you know, to me again is
Well, I was the youngest of 13.
Oh, 13.
My mother, my mom lost two sets of twins.
Oh, right.
Which, she lost two sets of twins at childbirth, and then I'm the youngest of the 13, and I have one remaining brother, Lewis. Living in Calgary, and Lewis would be 96, going on 97. Yes.
That's amazing. You just turned 85. Happy birthday, by the way.
Just turned 85, last Thursday, and I've had, I've had so many wonderful phone calls, emails, texts, and my phone is just full, and I'm trying to take them in priority and thank everybody. And then the young lady that works for the NHL, Melissa, and Kwame Mason, who made a film, and I'm in it. But anyway, they got together and contacted a number of players and people that were in the NHL, that played in the NHL. There was about 14 of them, and they sent me a birthday wish. They all said, yeah, congratulations, Willie, and thank you for your contribution, and blah, blah, you know, so and so. And it was really heartwarming. I had tears in my eyes when I was watching and hearing this from these people that I have known and seen from time to time during my travels, you know, with the NHL. And it was just wonderful. It was probably one of the best birthdays I've had after hearing and seeing these people.
I love that. And I love that, you know, this, you know, the culmination of everything, kind of the rediscovery, all the work you put in. I was at the Hall of Fame inductions in 18, And to see that, first of all, I gotta say, the fact that it took till 2018, I'm not gonna get on my soapbox, but that's ridiculous. for the record,
well, a lot of people said that, but then there was a couple of people in Fredericton, you know, they thought I was in the Hall of Fame,
as they should have thought. Yes,
you know, and they said, "What? Oh gosh, no, we've got to do something." So. There was a couple, Brenda and David Sampson, and they contacted a sports writer in San Diego and said, we've got to do something. Mm-hmm. We've got to get some petitions out. It says we've got to make this possible for Willie to get into the NHL. And so they made phone calls. They were fantastic. They really did, and they got enough letters, and they submitted it to the Hockey Hall of Fame, and they made it happen. And I thanked them in my speech. When I gave my speech, I thanked them, and I thanked the city of Fredericton and for all those people that stepped up and gave their submission and made it possible for me to, you know, to get into the Hall of Fame. And I thank some other people. You know, I thank Commissioner Bettman for his trust in me and his leadership. So it was nice. Yeah, and I feel good. And a lot of people now, they said, "Oh, you're a Hall of Famer." Yeah. And every time I get mail, you know, it says, or a card to sign, it says, please put Hall of Fame, Mr. O'Ree. So it's a nice feeling.
Mm. We talked about your experience in Boston. Can you still hear that crowd, that ovation on your first goal?
Yes. Mm. My first goal, it was like yesterday. You know, I was, we were warming up and we were playing against the Canadians and we were warming up. And Bronco Horvath, one of my teammates, he says, Plante was hurt. Charlie Hodge was a backup goalie. And Bronco knew Hodge. He knew where he was weak and where he was strong. So he says, Willie, if you ever get in on Hodge, keep the puck low. Keep it away from his glove. He's got a good glove. So that registered with me. So the game starts and the game's on. We're up a goal, and then Canadians get a goal. So it was a third period, and I'm playing left wing, and I break away from my check, and I put the afterburners on, and I'm just busting down left wing. And Leo Boivin, one of my defensemen, just hits me with a perfect pass. I didn't have to break stride or anything. And I get the puck, and I go in, and I go around the both defensemen, and I'm in on Hodge. And all of a sudden, he could hear this, low, low, Willie, keep it low. So I go in and I made a couple of moves on him. And then I shot the puck, and it was either right along the ice or it was just off the ice and hit the inside of the post and went in. And that made it 3-1. That made it 3-1 for the Bruins. And then about 6 or 7 minutes later, Henri, the pocket rocket, scored and made it 3-2. And the goal that I scored, you know, became the winning goal. And I can still hear the fans in the old Boston Garden. I got over a 2-minute standing ovation from the fans, and I can still hear it. And what a great feeling it was.
Mm. It was interesting to see, like you'd mentioned, maybe in the moment you didn't realize you were the first Black player in the NHL, but it did seem like the people around you, the crowds, you said the New York Times was writing about it, like there seemed to be in the moment an appreciation for what was happening, at least on some level.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I, as I said, when I read it in the paper the next day, and I said, oh my God, I said, this is great. And a lot of the Black players and players of color that I've had the pleasure of meeting, first was, you know, Jerome Aginla back. I got an invitation to attend his hockey school in Calgary.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, Willie, I'd love you to come. The kids would have a great time. So I go and I introduce the kids and, you know, I have a talk with them. And I'm skating around, and I wore CCM tacks all my life. It was the skate that I wore.
Yeah.
So I'm skating around, and the rep for there was, I forget his name, but he was there, and he represented the new skate, the Easton skate that's out.
Yeah.
And so he calls me over and says, hey, Willie, can I see you for a minute? So I go over to the boards, and he says, what are you doing with those CCM skates on? I said, well, CCM gave them to me, and I've been using them, in my clinics with the kids, and I wore them when I was playing pro hockey. He says, well, have you ever tried on or had the pleasure of playing with the Easton? I said, oh, no. I said, those skates are too expensive. So he says, how long are you going to be here? I said, I'm going to be here for probably another couple of hours with the kids, and then I'm going to be talking to the parents and some of the relatives after. He says, okay. So he leaves. And lo and behold, he comes back with two pair. Mm. And he gives me a pair, my size, and then he has a pair for Jerome. And he takes them into the training room, Jerome does, and he puts them in this little, it's a little oven type thing, you know, for a few minutes. And I put them on, and I can honestly say I haven't taken them off. Once I put them skates on, I wore them. I wear them from now on all the time. All the clinics that I do, I wear them. They are an unbelievable skate, you know. And they've been progressed so over the years. This was back in I came in '96. This was probably back in '98, '99, and you know. but they're a great skate, comfortable, and I enjoyed wearing them.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right, last thing. You had a quote. It wasn't your quote in your book, but it was a quote you said you like, and I've been thinking about it ever since. And the quote is, "Each man is three men."
That's right.
Yeah. Who he thinks he is, who others think he is,
and who we really are.
And who we really are.
And to look inside and deep down and find out who the really Willie O'Ree is, or who the really, you know, Bill James is. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. You know, when people look at me, they look at me and give me an impression of me, or somebody else will make another impression of me. But I think that's a good quote, and I wanted to make sure that it got into the book.
When do you think you really discovered who you really are? If that makes sense.
I don't think I've discovered it yet. Yeah. I really, you know, there's just things I want to do. There's things I still want to accomplish. I still set goals for myself, and you know, I've been awarded with so many awards. You know, and it just keeps one thing after another. You know, dating back to, I think, 82, I carried the Olympic cross back in 80, I think, 80, and then Lester Patrick was sent back, and the Order of Canada, and I've had a rink in Fredericton named after me, the Willie O'Ree Place, the rink in Boston. It's a street hockey rink. When the commissioner was there and the mayor Walsh was there, and then the documentary that's come out, the coin, the Canadian Mint produced a $20 silver coin piece in my honor, and I have my likeness on the front, and then the queen is on the back. And then the book now that's out, and I just keep thinking and saying, well, you know, the things that I've accomplished, and is there anything else that I can work at and work towards that can be another limelight.
Well, congratulations on the book, and Mr. O'Ree, this was a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time and for doing this.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure. I enjoyed it. Thanks so much. Thanks for thinking of me.
I want to thank Willie O'Ree again for joining the podcast. That was so great. I love it's like having those conversations. It's a piece of history. It's incredible to have those stories and to hear about him meeting Jackie Robinson and to try out for the Milwaukee Braves and to, you know, hit the ice in Montreal for the first time. And I'm so happy that and thankful that he was willing to take the time to share those stories. So thank you again, Willie, for doing that. A couple things before we wrap up. Just a loaded pod schedule at The Athletic. First and foremost, Laz and Scott Powers and their pod, Blackhawks Podcast, are having Stan Bowman on. I would encourage you to check that out. Stan is always a great conversation, and there is plenty to talk about when it comes to the Chicago Blackhawks and where they are in the transition. And, you know, we saw Jonathan Toews' comments recently, isn't loving the direction, so I'm sure they're going to get into all of that. So check that out. Ryan Clark, who we are excited to announce today, Ryan shared the news. He is going to be the Seattle Kraken's new beat writer, and he's joining the VanCast with Jeff Patterson and Thomas Drance. So check that out, Ryan. We are thrilled for this opportunity for Ryan in Seattle. He is going to kill it. Jonas Siegel and James Myrtle are breaking down the big Joe Thornton signing with the Leafs, and Eddie O, I'm sure, is going to talk about Doc Emrick and his impact. Edio, always a great guest on Two Man Advantage with Scott Burnside and Pierre LeBrun. All right. If in it, you can get all of those podcasts ad-free for Athletic subscribers on the app. If you are not subscribing to The Athletic, make sure you get in at a great subscriber discount at theathletic.com/full60 to get an all-access subscription. So to get the discount, it's athletic.com/full60. That's it. So thanks again now to Willie O'Ree for joining the podcast. Thank you for listening, and have a great week.